And our special guest tonight, Dean Radin, we're going to get into some of his experiments now on Coast to Coast AM. Dean, you didn't have a chance to finish up on what you were talking about on that fifth area of concentration on food and behavior, and then we'll get into your experiments.
Okay. Part of the additional motivation for this issue on food is a discussion I had a couple years ago with a lady named Dr. Anne-Marie Colbin in New York City. She's been teaching what she calls holistic nutrition for a long time. And as we were discussing it, she really brought to my attention this notion that there's something about the chef's intention that makes a big difference in the people who eat the food. And even in a very mundane case, for example, a really good restaurant will have, if you go into the back kitchen and you see what's going on, it may be a very efficient, but it's not an angry place. If it's too angry, like we see sometimes with celebrity chefs on TV,
sure,
I'm not sure I want to eat that food.
Well, that's true. Or keep in mind fast food places where generally some of the workers aren't happy that day.
And then you have a double whammy.
Yes.
You have food which is not so great for you in the first place, made by people who may not be so happy. So it raises questions that begin to challenge the biochemical model of food. So this led to, for years I was thinking about how do we do an experiment involving this. And last summer, a gentleman presented himself and to me, and it turns out that he owns the only chocolate plantation in the United States, which is in the big island of Hawaii. And the plantation's called Hawaiian Vintage Chocolate. Their website's hawaiianvintage.com.
All right.
And he said, well, this is a very interesting idea, because he also had the sense that there was something interesting about intention and food. And in his case, when he originally brought the cacao trees over to Hawaii, nobody knew if they were going to grow or not. But as it turns out, his plantation is next to a Buddhist monastery, and the Dalai Lama came to visit one day and was intrigued by the cacao trees, and so he blessed it. So this plantation basically began with a blessing from the Dalai Lama. You can't go bad from there.
You can't beat that, no,
right.
Not at all.
So he's interested in this intentional idea, and we said, okay, well, if you give me the chocolate, why don't we use chocolate as the food in this experiment? Now, I did this for a couple of reasons. One is that whenever you do a clinical trial, it's usually difficult to get people to volunteer for it, because they have to do something that's different during their daily life, and it may involve something unpleasant or whatever. In this case, though, we had to recruit people by saying, I'll tell you what, if you'll eat chocolate for 3 days, at the end of that, if you fill out these questionnaires, I'll give you $20. So we were overrun.
You would think they'd give you the $20
yeah.
after those 3 days.
Well, now that we did the experiment, we could have made probably more than $20. But the idea was we wanted to get at least 60 people, and after 120 people started beating down our door, we realized that this was probably a good design. So the experiment worked like this. And by the way, I would like to go back later to experiments involving water and
okay.
also photons, but I'll just concentrate on chocolate for the moment. The experiment was, first of all, it's a clinical trial, which means that it's not something happening in the lab, but it's happening in daily life. It's a real-world experiment. It's called a double-blind, randomized, placebo-controlled design, which is the gold standard in medical research. And what this does is it means that since we're giving people a substance to eat, like you might give somebody a pill to take,
mm-hmm.
they don't know whether it's a placebo or an active substance.
The old-called sugar pill, right?
Exactly.
The
in
placebo.
This case, it's chocolate. But it's chocolate that's either treated by intention or not treated by intention. And the double-blind part of it is that not only do the people eating the chocolate not know what they're eating, but I didn't know, and my research assistant didn't know either. So none of us could be biased by the handling of it or anything else.
Who did know?
Actually, the way we designed it was that the person who owned the chocolate plantation knew. He's actually a co-author on this paper.
Okay.
But he then prepared the chocolate elsewhere, gave it to us. So he was hands off once he gave us the chocolate.
Okay.
We had nothing to do with any of the participants. So we chose 60 people and we divided them into groups of 15, four groups of 15. So this is a small scale study, a pilot study. One group would get chocolate that was not treated. It's off the shelf chocolate that comes from Hawaiian vintage chocolate. You can buy it through their website. It's like a gourmet brand of chocolate of 68% cacao.
Okay, now when you say not treated, chocolate without that intention?
That's right.
Okay.
The same chocolate you'd buy right through the website. Then we had three different kinds of intentional processes that we exposed the other chocolate to. The first people exposing it or putting an intentional imprint were a pair of highly experienced meditators from the Deer Park Buddhist Center in Wisconsin. So this is a famous Tibetan Buddhist monastery, and two of the highly experienced meditators were asked to think a very specific intention to impress into the chocolate, which was in front of them.
Okay.
The intention was that a person eating this chocolate would experience an enhanced sense of energy, vigor, and well-being. We thought that was a safe enough thing to try to influence into the chocolate. And we explained it to the meditators, and they thought that was fine, so they went ahead and did it. The second method was to take a different batch of chocolate and get six meditators, also from the Deer Park Buddhist Center, and instead of having the chocolate actually in front of them, they had an electronic device which would capture their intention. This was the idea.
Mm-hmm.
So they meditated around this electronic device with the same intention. The device was then placed for 5 days in the vicinity of a batch of chocolate and allowed to, quote, play back the intention for five days.
Basically beam itself at the chocolate.
Right.
Okay.
The third method was a ritual performed by a Mongolian shaman that visits the United States once a year. His name is Zoritpatar Banzar. He's a chief shaman in Ulaanbaatar, Mongolia. I've seen pictures of this place, and it's like being on the moon. It's in the middle of nowhere, so it's a very classic Mongolian shamanism. He actually did this ceremony in our lab here in California, and I was present, and my research assistant, Gail Hasten, was also present. And we basically watched him do drumming and chanting and that sort of thing for about an hour over the chocolate. So then all these chocolates were all prepared independently from us and packaged in such a way so that all we knew is that they were A, B, C, and D.
Okay.
And we didn't know which was which. So we got those A, B, C, Ds back. We distributed it among the 60 people, randomly assigned to each group. And now the instruction for each person was, for each day over the next 7 days, we want you to fill out at the end of the day this mood questionnaire. The questionnaire is a very standard thing used in medical research and sociology research to see how mood states change as a result of some sort of intervention.
Is it a long questionnaire?
This one is actually fairly short. It's 35 questions. They all have to do with adjectives that describe various kinds of feeling and mood states.
Hmm.
You'd answer each question on a scale from not at all to extremely.
Okay.
So it's a five-point scale. This is then broken down into subscales having to do with the degree of tension you feel and depression and anger and vigor, fatigue, and confusion. And then you can combine all of those into a single score for mood. So they're told in the evening of each day over 7 days, think about your day and fill out this mood scale. Now, the first 2 days, they just do that. They don't eat any chocolate, and we do that to provide a baseline. The third, fourth, and fifth day, at 10 a.m. and 3 p.m., they're asked to eat a half an ounce of chocolate.
What a great experiment, Dean.
Yeah, well, they liked it. And, of course, we chose 10 a.m. and 3 p.m. because that's when blood sugar tends to drop and people are sort of hungry anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
So it wasn't difficult to get people to comply with the instructions.
And a couple ounces is, an inch by two, something like that?
Well, a half an ounce in each case. So it was a total of 1 ounce of chocolate per day for each day, which is like a candy bar. It's not that much.
Okay.
But this particular chocolate, like any gourmet chocolate, is extremely rich. You know, it's very high cacao content. So we told people, don't chew these up and swallow them. Don't wolf them down. Take each one of these little tabs. Each tab is like the size of a button. And just let it melt in your mouth and be mindful of how wonderful it is.
Savor it.
Right. And, of course, they had no idea whether this was the treated or the non-treated chocolate, but it was still chocolate, so how could it go bad? So they did that for 3 days, and then the last 2 days of the week, they didn't eat chocolate, and they just recorded their mood. Now, the hypothesis was that there would be an increasing difference in their reported mood state for people who ate the intentional chocolate as compared to the people who ate the control chocolate.
Moods would be better, they'd be happier, more jovial.
More vigor, I mean, specifically what we were intending, more vigor, less fatigue, and a sense of well-being enhanced over the other chocolate. So so we did this. Then the overall analysis showed that there was a significant improvement in the people who were eating the treated chocolate, a 67% improvement in overall mood. And then we did another cut on the data. We had planned in advance that since we recruited a wide range of people, that if a person tended to eat 2 pounds of chocolate a day, then on average, then asking them to eat another ounce is not going to make much of an effect because it's kind of saturated with chocolate anyway.
Yeah, and that's too much anyway.
Well, but actually one person said that she ate on average 10 pounds of chocolate a week.
10 pounds? Well, she's going to be a diabetic if she kept that up.
She looked like she could have lost some weight, but who am I to tell how much chocolate you should eat?
Yeah.
So so we divided the people into a group that ate less than the overall average amount. The overall average was 3.2 ounces of chocolate per week. So there turned out to be about 40 people who ate less than 3.2 averages, ounces per week.
All right.
And so we figured they would be more sensitive to this substance, since it was a combination of both the enjoyment of chocolate plus something else that we hypothesized. And in there, we got a much, much bigger effect. As I said, 67% overall, but in the people who only ate less than 3.2 ounces of chocolate, it was 10 times the effect. So their mood actually improved a huge amount. So actually, I was completely shocked at this result. I mean, the design is put into such a way that the double-blind nature of it and the randomized distribution of subjects and so on is designed specifically to get rid of any kind of bias.
Exactly.
And yet it showed up, and it's just mind-boggling to me. It's as close to magic, I think, as I've done any study yet.
What did you conclude by all this, then, with this?
Well, one thing that it suggests, well, first of all, it's a pilot study. So you don't want to revolutionize the world with a pilot study. We're going to have to do a much larger scale study to confirm it. But let's assume that the results that we saw at this point are real. I actually think that they are real. And one of the things it says is that what we know about nutrition is incomplete. Now, in some respects, that's not surprising to me because my entire career has been essentially to say that what we know about factor X is not complete. The world is full of all kinds of interesting things, and science tends to carve out only certain areas that it studies. So this is now studying the possibility that one factor of nutrition is intention, and intention can influence the nature of food itself.
Can intention, Dean, influence food that's not good for you, or only food that is good for you?
Well, we're at the beginning of an entire new realm of experimentation. No one has done this before, as far
Nobody
as I
knows.
Can tell. So we don't know the answer to that. One of the reasons we use chocolate, by the way, besides the fact that it was available from the Hawaiian vintage plantation, and by the way, the owner of the plantation said that I could announce tonight for the listening audience that if you go to that website, that there is still some of the intentional chocolate left over from the experiment that you can buy if you want to.
I love it.
One of the reasons...
Just in time for Valentine's Day.
Maybe. Exactly, although you'd probably be inclined to eat it yourself, I think.
That's true.
So chocolate is interesting because it what we were asking it to do, the intention that we were giving it, was pushing it in the direction that it normally does anyway. The main psychoactive ingredients in chocolate are caffeine and theobromine, both of which are stimulants. And one of the reasons people like chocolate is because it gives you a caffeine rush, and then theobromine gives you a much slower and longer rising rush. And it keeps you alert and makes you feel good. So we asked for the chocolate to do what it does best, but pushed it. What we don't know is if you can take, for example, a tomato, which you wouldn't normally associate with becoming energetic.
Mm-hmm.
Can we make a tomato become energetic? Well, maybe, but I think what I'd rather do is find out what a tomato does and push it in a direction that it wants to go anyway.
And also experiment, if you're ever going to do this, on genetically modified foods to see what happens to them.
Well, ultimately, where we want to go on this is, as I mentioned early on, that if we're going to have hundreds of millions of people who are starving to death, it would be really nice if we can come up with food that was a lot more energetically nutritious than what we are currently using.
Well, let's say a bowl of rice, for example. If you're able to increase that, the mere fact that that is so readily available, who knows what they can do with it?
That's right. And we're not talking about the amount. We're talking about not the amount of that's being eaten, but the actual energetic effect of it. So if it turns out that you could be completely satisfied and energetic with 2 tablespoons of rice, that would be great. I mean, there's a lot more food to hand out then.
Oh, that's phenomenal. And you would need how many people to meditate with the intention?
In this case, in one of the treatments was, oh, by the way, there are 3 different kinds of treatments we used. We used the shaman, 2 meditators,
right,
and the device. There's no significant difference in either 3 of those methods.
Okay, so you have data on that.
Right. So we're able to look at the difference. All 3 of them are significantly different than the control, but we don't see any strong differences. The trend is that the device that the 6 meditators were trying to impress their intention into the device, that gave a bigger result. But we don't know yet whether it's a significant result because there weren't enough people in that group.
I wonder if you can invent a device that doesn't need the human element to create the intent. What do you think?
Well, I think you need the human intent to begin with. But what we don't know yet about these devices is that if the device really can capture intention, then you can get the best meditators in the world and basically do the equivalent of a tape recording of their intention.
Put it on a CD.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, this really sounds nutty from a scientific perspective to capture intention in a device. And so I'm thinking, you know, my scientific colleagues already think some of the stuff I do is nutty. And it doesn't bother me too much because I know that at the leading edge of science, you're always going to run into stuff that just doesn't look right. But nevertheless, the evidence is what it is. You know, we're getting an interesting effect.
What does Edgar Mitchell think about some of these?
Well, Edgar likes all of this stuff. I mean, he was one of the original heroes who had a mission to outer space. And on the way back from the moon, he decided there was a new mission, which was equally interesting, which is the mission to inner space.
Kept it to himself, I guess, with his friend on Earth?
Well, at the time, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
But, I mean, so he founded the Institute of Noetic Sciences essentially as a place to have a mission to inner space. We want to find out, what is consciousness? What are the limits of consciousness, and how does it relate to the rest of the physical world?
Hey, Dean, when we come back, talk with us about the water experiment that you did and the one on photons. And then again, I'm going to ask you if these random generators are picking up current spikes, because a lot of people think something's going on. We might as well get it straight from the horse's mouth. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, we're really happy with the direction of Worker in Delight, our book. It's not on Oprah's book club yet, but who knows? Maybe one day she'll pick it up and decide to put it up there. But Worker in Delight is available at a substantial discount at Amazon.com. It's also available at your favorite bookstores. The first printing is completed. They have probably 1,000 or less copies of that left. Let's wipe them out if you want. Worker in the Light, Amazon.com, or your favorite bookstore. Back in a moment. And we're with Dr. Dean Radin. Dean, are you familiar with the work of Dr. Masaru Emoto, with the work that he's done with intention on water crystals?
Yes.
Amazing, yes. Isn't it?
It is amazing, yes. And in fact, the experiments that I've done with water were in collaboration with Dr. Emoto.
Okay, tell me about that one.
Well, we had an opportunity to meet, and I asked him questions about his claims about water because they look too good. I mean, it looks like it's an effect which is a very large effect and rather easy to produce.
Mm-hmm.
And if my work in this field has taught me anything, is that nothing is quite that simple. It's certainly not that easy. So I asked him whether someone had tried to replicate his effect using double-blind procedures, and the answer at that point was no. So I asked him if he'd like to collaborate on the study, and he said yes. So what we did was we had the possibility of completely replicating his system, which involves looking at the crystals under a microscope in a walk-in freezer, because otherwise the water would melt too quickly.
Sure.
But as he described the process to me, I realized that I didn't think I wanted to spend a week in a walk-in freezer looking at little ice crystals, partially because it's expensive and also because who wants to do that? So the way we designed this then was we would provide water to Dr. Emoto's laboratory in Tokyo, and he wouldn't know whether the water was treated or not treated by intention. And then that way we could tell whether the treatment actually did anything, even when they were not aware.
He would come back to you and say, look, and you would know what was treated by intention.
That's correct.
Okay.
And this way it would keep any kind of selection bias out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
Because the main criticism, most scientists at least, believe that the books that he's published are highly selected pictures. You know, like maybe you create a million water crystals, and you choose the ones that look good.
That happen to look perfect, right?
That's right. And so we don't know how many times do you need to do this process before you end up with a really nice looking crystal. So the first experiment that we did, which was published last September, involved 2,000 people in Tokyo who were shown a digital picture of two bottles of water in our laboratory here in California. That's about 5,000 miles apart. They're shown that digital picture along with a sequence of pictures from the Google Earth application to show the people in Tokyo where they were to aim their intention, 5,000 miles away. So that evening, they did their five-minute prayer of gratitude directed towards those two bottles of water. The next day, I took those two bottles and two other bottles, which were held in a different location as controls, and I randomized them into A, B, C, D, shipped them off to Dr. Emoto and told him to do his thing, crystallize these, and then send me back the pictures of the of each case where you think you find a crystal. So he sent back 40 pictures. And, of course, he and his lab assistant didn't know which ones were from which water. We did the analysis. But in order to keep our own bias out of the way, we asked people over the Internet to go to a website that I created, and they would see each of the 40 crystals in a new random order for each person. And so for each crystal, they were asked to simply mark down on the computer screen on a 7-point scale the degree of aesthetic beauty that they would assign each picture. So now we had thousands of people. We actually ended up using 500, the first 500 people. But lots of people went to the website and put down what they thought of each picture. And now we were able to create what amounts to an average aesthetic assessment of each picture done by lots and lots of people.
Fascinating.
Now the overall statistical analysis separates A, B, C, D into the two bottles which are treated and the two bottles which were not treated. And there was a significant difference between the two in the direction that Dr. Emoto claimed, that the treated crystals were on average slightly better, but statistically significantly better looking than the ones that were not treated. But the other thing that we saw from this experiment was that most of the crystals actually don't look that good. And in fact, in most cases, there's no crystal at all. There's just a blob. So the very beautiful crystals that show up in his books are selections, and they occur approximately 1% of the time. Nevertheless, because that experiment was significant and intended to support his claim, we then did a next step. We did another experiment. That experiment is now submitted for publication. It's out there being prepared for a journal. Okay. This is now a triple-blind experiment. And the triple-blindedness meant that now everybody in my lab, with the exception of one third party, was blind to which bottles of water we were handling. So we had one person who arranged the bottles into three different categories this time. Two bottles that distant groups would be aiming their intention at. In this case, it was mostly from Germany, total mm-hmm. of about 2,000 people. A second group of two bottles, which were directly underneath the two that were being aimed at, but were not known to the people sending their intention. So in other words, imagine a digital picture with two bottles in it, and that's what you're aiming at. But below that picture on the floor are two more bottles. And what this does is it creates a control that is very close to, but not known, at least not consciously known, mm-hmm. or not known in any normal way, to the bottles that they were aiming at. And then we had a third set of two bottles, which are outside this shielded chamber where all of the intention was being aimed.
That's interesting.
So the reason for these two control conditions now is that what we're really interested in is the two bottles that had the intentional aim at them and the what I call the proximal controls, the controls that were very nearby but not being aimed at by intention.
Right.
That was the difference we were interested in. That difference under triple-blind conditions turned out to be significant, again, in the direction supporting the idea that intention makes the crystals more beautiful.
So they get some ancillary fallout, I guess.
Well, no, because the proximal controls were not as beautiful as
Were not as beautiful.
No, not as beautiful.
Okay, so and they didn't get it. All right.
Yeah, they were within a couple feet, but since the people sending their intention didn't know about them, apparently there was no spillover, and there was a significant difference between them.
So you have to be aware of your direction, or you have to be aware of how you're channeling your intent.
That's what the result of this experiment would suggest.
Okay.
Yeah, that the there wasn't a field effect occurring, but an effect directly on this water itself. But again, in this case, after all of the pictures came back, only about 1% of the images would be considered a very beautiful image.
See, that's disappointing to me. I would have expected that to be way, way up there.
No, I think if it was a very high percentage of very beautiful crystals, then I would be suspicious. I mean, you don't get results that are that robust. All of the effects that I get in the lab, including even the effect with chocolate, the actual magnitude of the effects are pretty small. We know with high confidence that they're real effects, because that's what the statistics can tell us.
But I mean, are you going to get good crystal pictures without the intent as well? I mean, is that going to happen randomly?
Yes, it will. Some of the control pictures will result in crystals that look quite good. It's just that you end up with a larger number of better-looking crystals on average with the treated water than you do with the control water.
But why only 1% or 2%? Why not a little higher, 10, 15, even 20%? All right, not 70 or 80, of course, like I would love, but why can't they get it higher?
Well, we don't really know, but the one speculation is that we're dealing with a couple thousand people who were over 5,000 miles away, so there may be an effective distance.
I wonder if the same people who worked on and meditated the intent on the chocolate, if they were pulled in on the water, I wonder, because of their abilities, if the crystal pictures would have been higher percentage-wise.
My guess is yes, and we have some evidence that in this realm, intentional talent makes a big difference.
I want to talk about your light experiments in a second, Dean, but a couple quick questions. One, of course, is a lot of people are interested in these random generators. Are you seeing any spikes now?
No.
You're not?
No.
Okay, well, that's a good sign.
Yeah. By the way, and those we have over 200 formal events that we've analyzed so far, and the overall odds against chance for all 200 events is about 1.2 million to 1. So we have very strong statistical evidence that something is going on, but on the basis of any one event, we still can't predict if it's going to work or not. We need approximately 30 to 40 events, big events, worldwide events, in order to get a statistically significant effect. So even with the eggs, we're dealing with relatively small magnitude effects. But the statistics sound impressive, like 1.2 million to 1, but all of that's really telling us is that we have high confidence that what we're seeing is not a chance effect. But the size of these effects are fairly small.
You have been studying psychic phenomena for a long time, 25 plus years. You've got a story that I want you to tell us that you find to be pretty bizarre. Why don't you tell us about it?
Well, I guess before we get to the photon experiment, yeah, this is something that is simultaneously hilarious and horrific. And I take it as a cautionary tale. We need to go back in time to November, well, first of all, to 9/11. And as you remember, that after 9/11, the U.S. at least was determined to bring somebody to justice. And we figured out that the Taliban were supporting al-Qaeda in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
So we invaded Afghanistan, and everybody was concerned about weapons of mass destruction and whether al-Qaeda had it and so on. So on November 6th of 2001, CNN reports its headline, Bush says Bin Laden seeking nuclear bomb. A couple days later, CNN reports, or Christiane Amanpour reports, mysterious, ominous documents found in a safe house that was bombed by the U.S. in Afghanistan. This was an al-Qaeda safe house. They found mysterious documents. The next day, the headlines for CNN is nuclear attack, now anything seems possible.
Yeah, I remember that.
And next day or two, this headline is nuclear weapons-related documents found in this al-Qaeda safe house in Afghanistan, a discovery made even more significant in light of Taliban threats to bring about the destruction of America. So then there was a BBC report, a filmed report, showing some of these documents. And somebody noticed, I didn't notice at the time, but somebody noticed that the wording in this document looked a little bit strange. It was having references to uranium-235 and to atom bombs, references to TNT and so on, and headings which said things like how to make a nuclear bomb, which appeared to be downloaded off of the web somewhere. So a couple of years go by. You know, obviously there were no nuclear bombs, although there's still threats about dirty bombs.
Right.
But for about a period of a week or so, everybody was completely freaking out over the possibility that al-Qaeda actually had or was directly involved in some way in making a nuke. So now we go to a couple of years ago, and somebody comes to me and said, well, you know, your story was picked up by CNN and the Taliban. What do you think about that? I'm saying, what? What are you talking about? So as it turns out, the information that the Taliban had downloaded from the internet, among lots of other things, it turned out that they downloaded a story that I had written in a humor magazine in 1979. And the story in the humor magazine, the title was Weekend Scientist, Let's Make a Thermonuclear Device.
Oh, no.
And this is in a science parody magazine where I give instructions, a 10-step instruction about how you can build a nuclear weapon in your kitchen with common kitchen utensils.
And
you can tell then that this is exactly what was found by the BBC reporter and then was, of course, flashed around the world in it was talked about in the Pentagon, and you know Bush is raising the fear over it. And of course, I had no idea that the story which I wrote in 79 had sort of bubbled in an underground until the internet came along, and then it was replicated and copied again and again on lots of websites all over the place, none of them with the attribution of who the author was.
Oh, my. And it was a spoof.
It's a spoof. So the cautionary tale here is that I just wrote something for fun back in 79, which turned out to freak out the world almost 20 years later.
That's amazing. And the Taliban's running around thinking they're going to create a nuclear bomb out of household goods.
Well, no, they would need plutonium. And they would need
They've got to have that, of course.
Yeah, they'd need some soap and water, and I tell them they probably need a metal can and a few other things. But, I mean, the idea of how to make a thermonuclear device is fairly easy. But, of course, actually creating it to make it work is extremely difficult. The reason why I wrote this piece back in 79 is because at that time there was a student at MIT who, for a senior thesis, I think, he went to the local library and he figured out from public documents, how can you make a nuclear weapon just as an exercise?
Right.
Well, this made the news, and it went all the way up to, I don't know if the Supreme Court, but it went up to very high courts that were now determining whether or not this kind of information should be public because, you know, maybe people shouldn't know how to do this.
Yeah.
So I wrote the parody by saying that this information has been public for a long time. None of this stuff is secret at this point. The details of it are secret, and the ability to get enough plutonium and so on, those are extremely difficult, and rightly so. But the idea that that the courts should declare that we shouldn't be able to know something that we already know, I thought this was ridiculous, and that's why I published it in this parody journal.
Dean, when we come back at the top of the hour, we'll talk about your light experiment, and also we'll take phone calls. As the Global Consciousness Project proceeds, what do you see in the future for it?
Well, I would like to see that we begin to look at other forms of eggs, other kinds of detectors. Now, we've talked to colleagues who are working, for example, with giant neurons as a form of a random system.
Hmm.
The reason why this is interesting is because it kind of makes sense to us. We don't know if it's true, but it makes sense that a living detector would be better than a non-living detector, because if we're dealing with something to do with consciousness or sentience, then there's something interesting about living systems that is involved with that.
Yes.
So a neuron or perhaps an organic semiconductor or a plant would be a very interesting form of additional egg to add to the system.
All right, stay with us, Dean. We'll be back with you in just a moment. If you need to email me, that's simple. It's george@coasttocoastam.com. When we come back, we'll open up the phone lines. I can't believe how fast this program has been going. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.